So welcome, everyone, to this exciting discussion. We've got a number of people here in the room, and I think we have how many people joining via Zoom? Excellent. So there's 135 people joining this discussion via Zoom, and so I think this is a really exciting evening to be able to have a very crucial discussion about the way forward. And you know, the title of this meeting is DSA Adrift? We want to discuss tonight, what is the way forward to build a mass working class party for building a Marxist force in the U.S.? This is a discussion that will be, we'll have some panelists, and Philip Locker from Reform and Revolution, Laura Wadlin from Bread and Roses. On Zoom, we have Andy Cernicher from Tempest Collective and Matthew Strupp from Marxist Unity Group. This is a public meeting that is organized by Reform and Revolution, a Marxist caucus within the DSA. My name is Sarah Kimmerly. I am a DSA member, a Reform and Revolution caucus member. I'm also a nurse practitioner and an executive board member with SEIU 1199 Northwest. And I would turn it over to my co-host.
Hello, everyone. I'm Spencer. I use they, them pronouns. I'm on the steering committee of Portland DSA. I'm a member of Reform and Revolution Caucus, and I'm also the co-chair of the Reed College YDSA chapter. So just to start us off, here are some opening political remarks from the caucus. In the view of our caucus, Reform and Revolution, DSA entered a period of stagnation, internal disputes, and crises when Biden became president and when the Democrats won the 2020 elections. The following are the main problems that DSA is facing in our perspective. Instead of building towards an independent working class mass force, DSA is too often trailing liberals, both in political ideology and in organization. The dominant politics of DSA's political leadership focuses on different levels on building a reformist force that does not challenge capitalism beyond socialist rhetoric. Many DSA members do not understand this. However, all of these questions are subjects of discussion and debate within DSA at this time. In our view, the view of a Reform and Revolution caucus, the outcome of these debates will weigh heavily on all future attempts in the United States to build towards a rupture with capitalism and to build a democratic socialist society. And that's what we aim to discuss today. We want to discuss what this means to build towards a new mass working class party in the United States, towards strong Marxist forces moving forward, and how we as Marxists could or should relate to DSA in this ongoing crisis. We're very happy to have some wonderful panelists here, both in person and on Zoom. First, we have Laura Wadlin from the Bread and Roses Caucus and Portland DSA.
Next on Zoom is Andy Cernicher from the Tempest Collective and a member of the Madison DSA chapter.
Also on Zoom, we are joined by Matthew Strupp from Marxist Unity Group and a member of the Madison DSA chapter.
And here in person is Philip Locker for Reform and Revolution and a member of the Seattle DSA chapter. Thanks so much for being here and having this discussion amongst Marxists tonight. We will be posting the audio and video from this discussion on our website, reformandrevolution.org, so we will record the introductions and the discussion. If you don't want to be recorded while you speak, just let us know and we'll shut off the recording for that section. We will start this discussion with some rounds on the panel and then open it up for short contributions from the floor, physically here in Seattle and online over Zoom. And then the panelists will have a few minutes to close us off.
Alrighty, so to start off with our first prompt, the panelists are going to have 1 minute and or one sentence to answer this prompt. And first it's going to be Philip, then Laura, then Andy, and then Matthew. So the question is, in one sentence, what is the task for Marxists in 2023 in the US? What should we focus on? Philip, go ahead.
Be a long sentence, but 1 minute. I think you know the decisive starting point is to be in the struggles of our class, whether that's the workers at Starbucks, Amazon, UPS, or reproductive rights movements or other struggles, and where Marxist ideas are needed most. And that means being visible for those active socialists, which in my view is overwhelmingly a DSA, who want to fight back, who want political independence from the Democratic Party, and want a rupture with capitalism. And within DSA, those who are looking for an alternative to the opportunism that is dominating over DSA and its leadership, over its elected officials, and being visible and built and offering an alternative to that increasingly failed approach.
Great. Thank you so much, Philip. All right, so next up we have Laura. Go ahead.
Well, in one sentence, it's very simple. Our primary goal is to facilitate the self-activity of the working class. And by that I mean we're helping workers organize for power on their own behalf and developing a layer of Marxist leadership who can pull workers into motion along the lines of class struggle.
Great. Thank you, Laura. Next up, we have Andy. Go ahead. Okay, we're holding on a second here till we can get Andy on board. Just give us a moment. Apologies for the difficulty.
Okay. Hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to Reform and Revolution for putting this together. I put a narrow, tight sentence, so we'll see if this goes. So our task is we need to be honest and sober about our situation, grapple with the exhaustion of left reformism, and rebuild working class organization.
Great. Thank you, Andy. And finally, on this question, we have Matthew. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, everyone. And thanks to Reform and Revolution for putting this on. I'll read my run-on sentence. So, I'd say the main tasks of Marxists in the U.S. in the year 2023 are first, to fight to transform DSA into an independent mass Marxist party. Second, to put anti-imperialism on the political agenda and build public opposition to U.S. imperialism's global strategy, including its proxy war in Ukraine, over which DSA members in Congress have shamefully capitulated to militarism. And third, to carry on democratic agitation against the counter-majoritarian bourgeois U.S. Constitution in favor of a truly democratic republic of the working class. And I think we're seeing greater and greater opposition to the U.S. political order, for example, around the Roe v. Wade decision earlier this year. So that's it for me.
All right, thank you. Let's give them a round of applause. Try to keep the energy up. So next question will be Matthew, Philip, Laura, and Andy. And that question is, where is the left, socialist movement, and the wider labor movement at? For 4 minutes. Oh, sorry, they each get 4 minutes.
Okay.
Matthew.
So am I first on this one?
Matthew, yeah.
Okay. So I think the socialist movement, and I'll use that synonymously with the left, insofar as we don't have much of a non-socialist working class left, and I don't want to call the Democrats the left. I think we're still in a better position now than we were before 2016. We have a united organization in the form of DSA. It has tens of thousands of members. It's not a confessional sect, and it does have a degree of actual democratic organization that's superior to the sort of totally unaccountable NGO model of, say, the Working Families Party. However, the ability of DSA to project an oppositional politics separate from the liberal wing of the bourgeoisie has suffered since the Democrats came to power in 2021. DSA signaled that it would not be part of the Biden coalition when it didn't endorse him in 2020. But, many of our elected members have basically openly announced that they've entered into an alliance with Biden and the Democratic Party leadership. AOC goes around saying things like, I'm the one standing up for Biden's agenda. Posing themselves as the strongest fighters for, the things that Biden wants to do. I mentioned this in my, initial sentence. I think it's very significant that, the squad, all the DSA members in Congress have voted for, at this point, $23 billion in arms for U.S. imperialism's global strategy through its proxy war in Ukraine. That war is a major contributor to the inflation that's hitting working people in the pocketbook. It's sending many of the economies of nominal U.S. allies in Europe and the global south down the tubes. And, you know, this sort of capitulation to militarism, to imperialism, is downstream of the controversy over Jamal Bowman's votes for $2.8 billion in military aid to Israel last year. You know, he's sort of been soft expelled from DSA for that. They didn't, you know, include him for criticism in their criticism of other, the NPC didn't include him for criticism in their criticism of other DSA members in Congress over voting to crush the railroad strike because they don't even consider him part of DSA, but they didn't want to expel him. You know, not one penny, not one man for the system. Compulsory votes against military spending used to be principles of the socialist movement, but now we see DSA being dragged into support for the U.S. global strategy in spite of the organization's formal positions. As for the labor movement, you know, it's been experiencing a new wave of success in organizing. It's got youthful enthusiasm, and there's at least verbal gestures toward militancy, including from the top leadership of say, the Teamsters. But the lack of a working class independent political alternative in the form of an independent socialist movement is holding back the significance that these developments could have. For example, with the rail workers' vote in December, or was that earlier this month? I think it was in December. You know, you had a case where the Biden administration was using this extremely anti-labor Rail Labor Act and to crush, you know, working class activity. And you had every single member of DSA in Congress besides Rashida Tlaib voting in favor of using that provision, even though they wanted to sort of mask it with the sick day ruse. And that could have been an opportunity to agitate against, you know, capitalist politics, against the Democrats as well as the Republicans. But instead, they gave the Democrats credit for introducing this sick days amendment. And I think, you know, if we want to have a fighting labor movement, a militant labor movement, and a labor movement with militant, you know, youthful energy in it, it can't just happen from people, you know, doing things on the ground. It has to be tied to independent working class politics and an independent working class political expression. And I think that's lacking when DSA isn't taking that leadership role and is sort of continuing following the Popular Front politics that dominated its history for, you know, 40 years. And there were, you know, signals that it would be abandoning that. But we've sort of fallen back into that holding pattern without anything else cohering in a sort of solid, defined way as an organization. So I think that that's the rut we're in, and I'll leave it there.
Great. Thank you, Matthew. Next up is Philip.
I agree a lot with what Matthew is saying, but I think one thing I would try to bring to this discussion is, in order to assess where we're at, it's important to have a horizon, where we're trying to go. And speaking for myself, I think that to assess where we're at, we need to be clear where we're heading to go. And I think that starting point is the need for a fundamental socialist transformation of society, or to use an old-fashioned term, a socialist revolution in our lifetimes. And it's only against that bar that we can really measure what kind of progress are we making. And obviously, we are currently far from that, but I do think there's some promising signs in terms of the new wave of struggle and revolt over the whole past decade and over the past few years. It's starting, but I think we have to recognize it's starting from, historically speaking, quite a low level. It's basically a certain restart since the historic throwing back of the socialist movement with the collapse of Stalinism and the damage done by Stalinism and social democracy to the workers' movement and to the socialist movement. But we're seeing over the last few years the beginning of a rebirth, a restart. In labor, we have a long road to go to class struggle unions, but we've seen important steps forward with the new organizing, but also successes of reform efforts in the UAW, the Teamsters. And I think DSA reflects an awakening of a new generation that's in the U.S. that's searching for an alternative to capitalism. And I would see it in the framework as a step in the process of the working class finding its way towards the necessary political party and leadership that is required to take on the billionaire class
which is running the planet into the ground, into disaster, and fundamentally not just the billionaire class, but the system of capitalism. And that necessary political party and leadership is a mass working class party with a socialist program and a revolutionary leadership that's prepared to overthrow this system. I think in this period we have sort of, there's no lack of crises of capitalism, which provide opportunities for the working class to struggle. But what's holding our side back, the working class, I think are three fundamental crises that need to be overcome. And that is a crisis of leadership, a crisis of mass organization of the working class, and a crisis of consciousness. Of consciousness on a mass scale, not falling far from what's measuring up to what's needed objectively. So just what do I mean by that? Number one, the existing leadership of the labor movement and largely of most social movements on the left is simply not up to the task of combating, much less overthrowing, this crisis-ridden system. Matthew pointed to the four DSA members in Congress, and I think too often in DSA there's a dismissal. They have a leadership role. They have a voice and an impact far more than any of us in this room. They've used that to vote and support the policy of Biden and U.S. imperialism in this proxy war in Ukraine, which is disgraceful. They also voted, as it was said, but also in the labor movement. It's not just the DSA Congress members. The leaders, very often there's been criticism, justly so, of the role the DSA members in Congress played in the railway contract. But the leaders of the railway unions all agreed to Biden's ridiculous tentative agreement before Congress even voted on it and recommended to their members to pass it. So that tells us a little bit about the crisis of leadership. Just wrapping up, I think we also have a crisis of mass working class organization. There's been an enormous throwing back of unions over the past several decades. We're beginning to see a recovery of that. There's a lack of a mass working class political party, and that means it's much harder for the working class to act as a cohesive, coherent, independent social force in society. Instead, we have the working class being atomized and unable to cohere itself. And finally, the last thing I would say is in terms of mass consciousness, there's a huge anger at the political establishment and big business, an intense COVID radicalization. But despite that huge anger, still consciousness is still, historically speaking, quite low. It's much more, in our assessment, a left populist consciousness of the more active elements than a clear-cut socialist consciousness, much more looking towards the people as the agent of change rather than the working class as an independent social force, which is the decisive force for changing society.
Thank you, Philip. And next up is Laura.
I share a lot in common with Philip on my perspective on this question. On the left, there's a misconception that the working class is ready to revolt and we'd be on the eve of revolution if not for the traitors and the liberals and the bureaucrats and the opportunists standing in our way. And that's not to say they don't stand in our way. Certainly they do. They will. But right now, there isn't a lot for them to stand in the way of. And the reality is that the working class remains historically disorganized, and very few working class people have developed revolutionary consciousness or leadership skills through participating in class struggle. The socialist movement, the left, and the labor movement were not well prepared to handle all the crises that have come our way over the past few years. Like when COVID appeared, many unions, including my own, missed an opportunity to use our leverage to get major protections, and the left didn't make any gains on healthcare policy. During the Black Lives Matter resurgence, millions of people were politicized and participated in protests, which shouldn't be minimized, but the politics of that moment were confused, and ultimately we made virtually no gains on addressing police violence. And so much of that, the energy of that moment fell into useless and outright fraudulent NGOs. And the response to Roe being overturned was fleeting, and we couldn't come up with a vision, an action plan with a national scope. The railroad crisis was also was an unprecedented opportunity to demonstrate the power of a strike, but reformers in the unions were pretty far down a really steep hill in reforming those unions. And there are plenty of very similar examples to that playing out across the labor movement across the country. And during all of these moments, DSA had minor surges in membership, but we weren't really able to capture the moment to build something bigger. We have dozens of electeds at all levels of government, but they've had mixed effectiveness in putting the socialist banner forward and making the most of a crisis. So our task is to build the organizational infrastructure necessary to be able to make the most of a crisis. There will be many more to come, for sure, and even more dire. There's going to be natural disasters, crises of legitimacy in government, industry shutdowns, that kind of thing. And we aren't yet at the point where we can harness that turmoil completely in our favor, but we can get there. But despite all these weaknesses, it's not all bad for socialists and for labor. There's a growing consensus on the left that union organizing is the path forward, and that's very good news. Unions are more popular than they've ever been, especially among young people who are basically the vanguard of a growing movement for independent unions, like at Starbucks, for example. And across industries, people learned during the pandemic that their employers are pretty much fine with letting them rot and die, and that changed them in a way that you can't really come back from. I really believe that leftists have learned a lot in the past few years. We've learned a lot of hard lessons, and there's only so much you can learn from reading and listening to your elders, which you should do. We should all do more of that. But we also need more people to learn by doing. You have to fight and fail, and there's no shortage of opportunities to do both.
Thank you. Andy, you're up. You're getting there. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll take a little bit of a different tack. So in the 2010s, there were a bunch of left electoral challenges that popped up in many countries, mainly in Europe and North America. And every situation had its particularities, but they all arrive roughly at the same time, and they have similar trajectories. And practically all of them reached a level of exhaustion with what they could do. So in the Anglophone world, Corbyn was defeated twice. And despite momentum existing in the UK Labour Party, the party was successful in routing Corbyn and his supporters. Sanders won some states away from Clinton in 2016, and he was completely boxed out of the Democratic Party convention at that time. When he ran again, he did significantly worse than he did in 2016. And for some reason, many socialists pretended that they didn't know that the Democratic Party had already demonstrated that what it would do to prevent these kinds of challenges. So socialists that were relating to the situation have to really come to terms with the fact that this particular conjunction is over, right? That's been very difficult in the US because there was an immense ideological operation, I think, to mobilize people to campaign for Sanders. But I think that in the last year, DSA members have started to respond to, you know, this new period in one way or another. Either they're outright saying it or they're doing things that demonstrate that they're recognizing that things are different. The leadership structure in DSA is responding by reverting to its most of its like Harringtonite positions that it had, specifically regarding its position on the Democrats and the trade unions. So the socialist left is reconfiguring itself again in relation to new developments and their evaluations. There's new international situation as well, and the question of self-determination comes up in a big way, and it's going to have some pretty profound consequences for how we relate to the entire international situation. There is a wider left that's not part of the socialist movement, however. Most notably, there's a radical left that's centered around Black Lives Matter and abolition, and largely the Black left has developed separately from groups like DSA. I think that's important to say because it's not like it's DSA and then there's nothing. There's a substantial political ecosystem out there. But we're in a contradictory moment in general. So comparatively, yes, there is a lot of activity among US workers and it's very exciting. It opens up a lot of new possibilities. But at the same time, the labor bureaucracy is basically content to accept its decline, while at the same time guarding its fealty to the Democratic Party and to business unionism. So, for example, last year, there were strikes at all of these food production companies over the right to basically not be worked for 80 hours a week. People voted no on their contracts, but the BCTGM maneuvered to end their strikes without winning the demands. So you can see that there's like a general anger at the status quo. Enough people will vote no on contracts, but it hasn't developed to be able to withstand this kind of bureaucratic encirclement. I think the real danger is that without some class expression, it's going to move right. And I've heard people speak pretty positively about the Teamsters. I'm a Teamster. That's not my experience. But for instance, after the rail deal, you saw that Tony Cardwell from the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees went over straight away to go be on Steve Bannon's talk show on Fox. So I think that's a real danger.
Thanks, Andy.
All right, so at this point, we will be moving on to our next question. And the order for this is Andy first, then Matthew, then Philip, and then Laura to wrap us up. And the question is, do you agree that DSA is in a crisis since Biden won the presidential elections? If yes, what's at its core? Andy, you're first for this. Go ahead.
Am I first? Because I'm the guy that usually says yes. So look, I'll start with some description of what's going on in the organization that I think is important before we just give subjective takes on this, right? So the first one is, I think it's important to note, right, at the 2021 convention, Maria Svart, who is the national director of DSA, stated that membership growth had slowed to a trickle. We had not received actually any more information about the membership figures until Jenbo leaked them, in which she said, in August of 2021, we had 94,687 total members, 77,000, about 81% were members in good standing. Now we're at 86,977 total members and 64,000, which is 74%, are in good standing. So that's a loss of 12,000 members, or about 15% of the organization, right? It's a pretty big deal. At the same time, you got a staff report on the state of the organization, which stated that they were unable to contact large numbers of chapters. They just could not get in touch with them, had no way of knowing what was happening. And among many that they were reaching, they were reporting a level of exhaustion and burnout unlike any they had seen. So you can read that report. I'm happy to link it if you want to see it. And then the last thing is, you have an enormous, just dysfunction on the National Political Committee. Again, like, you know, we've seen this in a bunch of different ways. But, you know, I did an interview with Jenbo to explain, like, what is going on with this. And, I mean, they violate their own rules. There's, you know, what resignations, all kinds of shit is happening, right? That's generally what I would call not good. So I think, yes, there is a crisis, right? If that's not a crisis, I don't know what you call that, right? But something significant has happened in the life of this organization. What I would say analytically, right, is that this organization was built on a specific conjuncture, right? Roughly around 2016, two things happened. Trump got elected, Bernie Sanders ran a campaign that said it was Democratic Socialist. People go on Google and find Democratic Socialists of America, and then they join an organization that you didn't have to do anything for, right? That's fine. That period existed up until, you know, basically the second Sanders campaign in 2020, at which point Sanders, like I said, did significantly worse and conceded and backed Biden way before the convention period. I think some people were expecting it was gonna be another convention battle. That never even got close to happening. Sanders conceded, joined the Biden campaign, and basically said, I'll be the strongest fighter for Biden. So that entire understanding and immediate horizon was over. And there was no real consideration of what to do beyond that. Yes, we did vote to say we would not endorse Biden. I wrote that resolution and I fought for it, right? And, you know, it has been a period of people, like on the leadership trying as hard as they can to circumvent that. And essentially the strategy among the NPC after 2020 was to join Build Back Better and to attach all the hopes of DSA's programmatic tasks onto Build Back Better. The Green New Deal, the PRO Act, all that stuff was seen as being part of the infrastructure bill. And that meant that you had to elect those Democrats, we basically had no discussion about this as an organization. That just happened, right? And then it failed also. So this organization at this point has no political unity, right? It has no sense of what it's trying to accomplish in common. And so you start to have all kinds of these like symptoms of that political dysfunction that's happening in terms of members leaving the organization, that's happening in terms of chapter leaders, people that do the day-to-day work being exhausted and not knowing why they're doing it anymore. And it, you know, makes the leadership feel like they don't have to give a fuck about what anyone thinks anymore, and they can just, you know, make whatever rules they want to. So I'll cede my time. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Andy. All right. Next up, we have Matthew. Go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah. So, like Andy, I would say the answer to this question for me is yes. I do think DSA is in a crisis since Biden won the presidential election. I think what Andy outlined is a starting point for answering why that is. It's true that since basically 2021. DSA has, not continued its explosive growth pattern. It's worth pointing out that a lot of that growth up to the 2021 convention happened, during the recruitment drive in 2020. So, we're about the size we were in 2019, basically. But a lot of DSA's political strategy from 2016 until Biden got elected was, we aren't out to realign the Democratic Party. We know that we have to break from it at some point. This is the dirty break idea. But that is a question sort of for the future. And it's something that we will be able to figure out how to do effectively, as DSA grows, as it continues its explosive, rate of growth. And I think the combination of DSA's growth slowing down in terms of membership, decreasing a little bit since 2021, and Biden coming to power is what's, in part causing this crisis. The idea that it'll automatically work itself out as DSA grows and we get more ability to exert leverage, is gone. And the benefits that are touted for supporting the Democrats, become a lot more tangible when they're in power. We see this on the national level with the relationship of the squad to Biden, to Nancy Pelosi, now Hakeem Jeffries, we'll see. And then, you see it in New York with the Socialists in Office Committee basically saying, we won't run as a united slate and all endorse each other because, they threatened to, because the Democratic leadership threatened to not bring some of the proposals of the Socialists in Office up for a vote or to give them political favors. So the allure of kneecapping ourselves as a movement in order to get some gains has become a more tangible benefit than building our independent identity as a movement. And I think that's a large source of the disorientation of DSA since Biden won the presidential elections. I also think that some of it is a lack of a clear idea of what DSA should be. There's no idea that we are out to be an intransigent working class political opposition party at the highest level that represents, the broadest revolutionary interests of the class. The idea is that, we work in the shadows behind the scenes to create the best the best conditions for the class to do what it needs to do. I think that that's a wrong vision of political leadership. I think that that's borne out historically, that the working class movement on the ground level benefits best when socialists are acting as tribunes of the people, spreading the most hard-hitting message of the class, and then inspiring, political action that comes below. I think you see it in part in what Bernie Sanders did in 2016, although his politics ran into the limitations that Andy mentions, but because they were so much higher than the absolute lack of class consciousness that existed previously, he was able to have that effect of bringing forces into motion behind him. So I think what we need is working class politics, high politics. As an organization, you know, we need to chart our course as an independent working class party, and have faith in the ability of our movement to exist as an independent political identity that can have transformative effects and not buy the allure of, you know, sucking up to the Democrats when they're in power, because those gains are illusory, as we see with the, you know, the rail workers debacle. Even when they hold out the 7 days of paid sick leave, they will find ways of you know, pulling away the football at the last minute. So that's my take on that.
Great. Thank you, Matthew. All right. Next up on this question, we have Philip. Philip, go ahead.
I mean, I will, yeah, give a resounding yes. DSA is in a crisis. I think maybe more, maybe you want to say a slow motion crisis, but it's definitely a crisis nonetheless. And that's against the background of DSA having explosive growth from 2015 to 2020. But as the other speakers have said, we've seen a stagnation and then a loss of members since then. About, I think Andy said 15%. Even more significantly, I think, is that you have a decline in active member participation in chapters across the country. And there's a lack of cohesion about and common understanding, as was said, about what is our strategic task in this period, what's the way forward, whereas there was more of that in the Bernie-Trump era. And that is really missing. I think, unfortunately, one of the problems in DSA is that there's an that feeds into this is the dominant thinking is that problems are organizational. What are the organizing techniques and practices to avoid burnout, to activate members, to run a campaign? And I think, to be blunt, I think that's completely wrong. DSA's organizational capacities, if anything, there's definitely plenty of room for improvement. It's not the gold standard. But if we are far better today than they were in 2015 to 2020. So that does not explain the crisis in DSA. The root is political. There was political agreement and cohesion around tasks in 2015 to 2020, at least sufficient to get to where DSA could. That we are in a fundamentally different political situation with Biden and the Democrats in power, and we need to face up to a new situation. And it was a serious failure of the 2021 convention, which the majority of the DSA leadership thought was dismissed, to not prioritize using the convention and the pre-convention period as a tool for collective political assessment, political thinking, and political reorientation. That was a hugely missed opportunity. We're paying the price. I would say it's not just DSA. Social movements have been in an ebb since Biden took office, with the exception of the promising developments in labor. But on the whole, there's an ebb. And Andy pointed to the alternative of BLM. I would just, I think there's lots of truth in what Andy said overall, but I would point out BLM is in a far bigger retreat and crisis than DSA. If you see what's DSA is, I mean, BLM is completely absent from the streets compared to the high points of 2020. The crisis of leadership in BLM, how that's been, you know, Laura spoke about that earlier. So I don't think that paints a very favorable contrast to DSA's in trouble, but I think we have to keep it in the bigger picture of the left as a whole has not turned the corner of how to face up to this new situation with Biden and the Democrats in power. I think part of that is that it's the price we pay for DSA's success. The most high-profile, impactful part of DSA has been its electoral work, and that success that was scored in the previous period, we're now seeing the question of a relationship to the Democratic Party leadership is posed much more sharply with the Democrats in power than in the previous period when they were in opposition. And that situation, the Democrats in power, requires DSA electeds to advance their own working class and socialist program independent of the Democrats, who are now running the US government and US society on behalf of the capitalist class. To be clear about it, they're not running it on behalf of socialists or progressives. And in that context, we need a militant oppositional stance to the Democratic Party leadership, always striving to have an independent and high public profile to to let them, let working class people know a clear message that we are building a socialist opposition to the ruling class and big business and their government, including Biden and the Democrats, that we're not on the same side with them, and not let the right exploit the growing discontent, and stressing the need to our supporters, the millions who look towards the four DSA members in Congress and the tens of millions who look to Bernie Sanders, to not rely on Congress to change things. That's not where change is going to come with the Democrats in power, but we need to get organized. We need to build mass struggle, and that means our leaders, like those in Congress, need to use their platform to call for and help promote mass actions rather than just a congressional parliamentary approach to change, and a call most and have the clarion call to get organized in terms of joining DSA and building a mass democratic membership organizations like DSA, unions, et cetera. And instead, we've seen the really opposite. In this period of the Democrats in power, we've seen the DSA electeds increasingly in Congress be incorporated in the Democratic Party as a loyal opposition rather than an insurgent, militant opposition. I think we need, or there's a real reckoning that needs to take place in DSA about its electoral strategy and a sharp change if we're gonna overcome the situation.
Great, thank you, Philip. All right, last to speak on this question is Laura. Go ahead, Laura.
I really agree with the comment that our problem is not simply that we aren't adopting organizing best practices, and we have to reckon with the reality of the numbers and the fewer active DSA members. It's not good. But I don't think it's a simple causal relationship of Biden won and now we're in crisis. The horror of the Trump presidency combined with the hopeful vision of the Bernie Sanders campaigns was pretty magical in terms of politicizing people, but that ended 2 years ago, and we haven't had anything remotely comparable to take its place. And it's really not surprising that without a literal socialist running for literal president, people just don't have socialism on their minds as much anymore. Most leftists had, I'd say, no illusions about the Biden presidency. It's not like the Obama situation where the left was demobilized by his victory. But DSA doesn't have a common vision or even a common project right now on the national level. I mean, we do in some senses on some committees, but they're not as great cohesion as we should have. And so we're not really acting in the world. People don't see us as a force for something in like the world that they experience. And that challenge is unfortunately baked into DSA's nature as a big tent and fairly decentralized organization. And as frustrating and immobilizing as that is, that nature is also partly what makes DSA such a special and important organization. And we haven't fully worked out how to resolve those contradictions. I'd also say we need to look at this crisis in the context of the history of the left, because we have this crisis of like purpose and direction. You know, as far as socialist organizations go, leftist organizations go, their periods of activity go up and down. And so it would be foolish to give up on DSA or say it's a lost cause just because we're in a downturn. But it's also wrong to think that DSA doesn't face a serious risk of irrelevance and collapse without addressing the issues of democracy in our organization. DSA is especially democratic. It is almost uniquely democratic in social movements these days, unfortunately. But even our highest leadership body, the National Political Committee, is gatekept out of key political decisions in a way that verges dangerously close to the staff-led NGOs that we deride. So we would be able to act at least a bit more decisively if leadership elections and what we pass at the convention actually meant something. And I think we would have a much more effective electoral strategy, one based less in insider politics and more on raising the socialist banner, if we succeed in addressing this problem at the 2023 convention. But despite all of DSA's many problems, it's still the best chance we have at a launch pad for a future Workers' Party. In Portland, our membership numbers continue to fall, and yet we are a stronger chapter than we've ever been. We have a massive network of union organizers and leaders that have come and joined DSA because of the solidarity actions that we've done alongside them. And we are recruiting from among this network to run a slate for public office of union leaders and workplace militants that are DSA members or DSA adjacent. And it's hard to imagine something like that happening through another organization. So that's certainly worth fighting to save.
All right, so given all that, and I think you guys have touched on this to some extent, but how do we get from where we are now to a strong working class party and to a strong Marxist tendency rooted in labor and movements? And sorry, Laura, you're first, and then Andy, Matthew, and Philip.
We have a lot of challenges before us, but I really believe that the future is promising. There's a contract campaign at UPS where 340,000 workers could go on strike this year. And this could set an example for how to take on the employer class, the capitalist class, and it's an amazing opportunity for DSA chapters to do some serious strike support that could lead to building the network of workplace militants that we've done in Portland. And unfortunately, we have very little time left to prepare. It's going to come very quickly. Contract expires July 31st. But we have to make the most of the time we have to make sure that we're taking advantage of the crisis that will pose, like I was talking about earlier. The decisive force in the coming period will be the power of the organized rank and file activists. Many union leaders today remain wedded to conservative business unionism and are trapped, playing a subservient role to the Democratic Party. And so it's our task as democratic socialists in the labor movement to link up with the militant minority of workers who want to organize to fight their bosses and push for a new class struggle unionism, one that fights to democratize the labor movement, put it on fighting footing to take on corporate power, and champion allied causes that build working class power broadly. Rebuilding a fighting rank and file-led democratic labor movement is at the core of our strategy to build a socialist future in the United States. And we can't do that outside the labor movement as observers or merely union members. Having a union card doesn't mean you get to talk and your coworkers care. We have to be workplace leaders, people that our coworkers trust and respect. And like I said in the beginning, our task is the self-activity of the working class. As Marxist leaders, we pull our coworkers and fellow working class people into motion with us, and they learn how to fight, and we build something bigger.
Thank you. Next up is Andy. Can you unmute Andy? Andy's up.
Okay. So I think what we should be clear after the last 6 years is that we are not going to get to an independent working class party without people who are consistently saying that that is what we need. Not in 40 years, not when some Democratic politician magically does something that we hope they will do, but they've actually shown no evidence of doing. So we have to start the work now. The history is clear, and we've published a lot of this on Tempest. There's never been a dirty break or a party surrogate or any other scheme working in another party that has led to independence. Not in building the UK Labour Party, not in the Nonpartisan League, not in the CIO PAC. Every one of those attempts to be dirty has largely been an appeal to stay in the liberal or bourgeois formation and to disarm the militants who have been pushing for independence or neutralize workers who were already voting socialist or communist at that time. There is no historic example of an independent workers' party being formed that way. So the continued desire to build through the Democratic Party at this point is either wishful thinking despite clear evidence, or it's purposeful obfuscation for those who just don't believe in building an independent party. So many of the advocates of the dirty break or party surrogate things lately have just washed their hand of that rhetoric entirely and said that this was always just about realignment now that we're done with that. So again, we have to be clear about the need for independence. We have to push for independence consistently, and we have to defend the independence we have when we have won it. And that entails taking initiatives for independent campaigns and challenging the de facto integration of labor and social movements into the Democratic Party. A lot of this is going to depend on a much bigger wave of struggle to create the sense that this is necessary and possible on a large scale. It's going to mean a labor movement that is radically transformed from business unionism to something that's much more like what Joe Burns calls class struggle unionism. And those things just don't happen. They take a lot of long, hard work to build and set up. And if we don't start doing that, there won't be, like, it's just not going to happen whether or not there is a wave. We're not going to get independence out of it. It doesn't magically happen. So Marxists have to understand that history is not a linear process. It's not just brick by brick organizing, but things move in leaps, and we have to prepare for that.
All right, Matthew?
So I'll try to, start off my jumping off point as what Laura and Andy have already said. So I think, Laura's right that there is a potential for DSA members to be very involved with the current, wave of militancy in the labor movement, reform efforts, et cetera, and to build ourselves up as an organization and as a socialist movement by engaging with the labor movement. I also think Andy's right that we need to be talking about independence and, trying to figure out how to become independent consciously and openly in order to get there. Andy says there's never been an example of the dirty break happening in history. I'd like to know exactly what's being defined as a dirty break. I mean, UK Labour came out of sort of LibLab formations, and Babel and Liebknecht were initially a faction of the Saxon People's Party before splitting and joining with a faction of the ADAV. So there's histories of splitting off of bourgeois parties and forming independent workers' parties, but they happened when people advocated for them and agitated for them and made the argument that we need independent working class politics and we need Marxist politics. The Democrats are able to sometimes talk like reformists and talk like a labor party, and they have unions, union bureaucrats signing up to them, donating to them and following them around. So it's not that we don't have a party that the unions support, they support the Democrats, but we need, working class politics that advocate for the long-term interests of the class as a whole. And so I would really say that requires, an organization like DSA. I think it's incredibly important in this equation, and it requires struggling in DSA for a conception of what it wants to be, which is an independent working class opposition party, with a Marxist program. We have a platform. It's, strength is that it's a comprehensive political platform. I would say that there are some weaknesses in certain formulations and framings in it, but I would definitely not want to replace it with anything weaker. And I think it's a positive step forward that we adopted that in 2021. But I think that the real key is this party question, and in fighting for DSA to take on that self-conception as an opposition party of the working class. It's true that we have a new wave of militancy in the labor movement. Since the Black Lives Matter movement, there are, more people, thinking about anti-racist politics. But without organization, none of that means anything. and political organization is the highest form of working class organization. It sees the longest term interests of the class as a whole. And an organization like DSA, you know, in the long history of the left, as we've been talking about, is a significant entity within US history. And to pass up the opportunity of DSA's existence, it not having cracked down on Marxists inside of it, like even you know, left reformist parties in Europe, the Socialist Party of the Netherlands, which is sort of left populist, you know, kicked out hundreds of its Marxist members a couple of years ago. DSA doesn't have that sort of internal police regime at this point. And so we can really struggle to transform it into something else. And that does involve, that does mean democratizing it, you know, fighting against unaccountable staff, fighting for a real party press and for real debate within the organization. You know, they stripped down, you know, the size of Democratic Left, the official DSA publication, from like 8 pages to 4 now. I mean, it's just a fundraising, you know, glossy mailer now. And we need real, you know, publications and forums for debate like this, in order to cohere what we're about as an organization, like Laura and Andy were saying. So I think that those are the essential questions. I think that this 2023 convention offers a chance, you know, if there is an opportunity for democratic debate at it, and we should be fighting for there to be an opportunity for democratic debate. But, you know, to the degree that it exists, it's a vital moment to push for these fundamental reconceptions of DSA's politics. So yeah, I think DSA, the party question in DSA is incredibly important for answering how we get to a strong working class party and you know, real Marxist politics.
Great, thank you.
Well, definitely, getting to a mass working class party and a powerful Marxist force in US society is a bigger question than just DSA. DSA is not the full answer. It's gonna require a number of things to get there. But I do wanna focus on DSA as the thing I'm most familiar with, and I really agree what Matthew was saying about it's a vital arena and a vital experience that will have a big impact on beyond. It might not be the form of DSA in a few years from now, but the core people who go through this experience will be a key part of, if something more dynamic and vital emerges out of that. And I think these two questions are interwoven about building a strong working class party and a powerful Marxist backbone for it and in the workers' movement and on the left. And part of, I think, DSA really shows we're increasingly hitting the limits of what can be achieved on the basis of the current political framework of DSA, that there needs to be a fundamental course correction. I agree the dirty break is purely on paper, and we need to actually, there needs to be concrete steps to implement it. Part of that is a struggle to hold our elected officials accountable, as to be accountable to what? To represent our organization, to represent our interests, to be our voice. If we cannot succeed, that's a basic task that this new organization has to learn how to do. And there's not like, it's not like if we just, there's not like there's a simpler, easier path outside DSA. That's a struggle that exists in the labor movement. It's a struggle that exists in DSA. It will be a struggle in new future attempts. There needs to be a fundamental course correction in terms of the war in Ukraine, highlighting the importance of anti-imperialism. I think in this country, first and foremost, that means opposition to our own imperialism, of US imperialism, but also against all other imperialisms in the world, including Russia, China. And we need also, I think the framework that DSA is in that needs to be broken out of is we need also a rupture, a policy of a rupture from capitalism to raise horizons. Too often in DSA, the discussion about socialism really boils down to a kinder, gentler capitalism, accepting the basic premises of capitalism. And instead, we need to have a much clearer picture in this crisis, in this era of crisis after crisis, of a fundamental different social order. To get out of that broken framework in DSA, I think we need the key barrier is the opportunist politics and methods that dominate DSA, and I mean that in the Marxist sense of opportunism, that the dominant politics in DSA
of uncritically supporting and echoing what's popular politics of other non-Marxist forces on the left that are playing a leading role in the working class and in different movements, and watering down an independent socialist program and strategy to accommodate to the existing level of consciousness, however, when it's confused, and the existing framework of power and relations of power that exists in the workers' movement and the left. I think the other side of it that we see in DSA is we need to overcome there's a left in DSA that's dissatisfied, that's rebellious, that sees the need for change, but too often is held back by a self-limiting, self-isolating ultra-leftism. And we see that also outside DSA. And we need to politically equip those more rebellious forces that are looking for radical change, who are looking for Marxist politics, to, yes, harness that energy, but in a way that can be effective and actually can offer a viable challenge to the leadership of DSA and labor and other left movements. So, and I think that's part of the discussion and debate we have. It too often, there's our sort of sterile approach of self-proclamation, that we can just denounce the existing leaders or the members of Congress or the leaders of DSA and just affirm, we proclaim ourselves as an alternative, that we're the leadership, and that has to be earned and won. And I think I would appeal to some of the Marxists in and around and outside DSA who are critical. I agree with those criticisms, but the question is, do we just proclaim that it's not working, or do we actually fight, wage a struggle to win a majority in DSA against the current increasingly bankrupt policy? The same thing in the labor movement. We know the labor leaders are bankrupt, but are we gonna walk away from that struggle, or do we wage a fight within the labor movement to win a majority of workers for a fundamentally alternative class struggle approach?
All right, thanks to all the panelists. We want to open it up for a broader discussion, but before I do that, I wanted to make a plug for Reform and Revolution's magazine. It is it has both articles from across the US, interviews, analysis, and debate, and there's also international content as well, both from activists on the ground and struggle around the world. There's beautiful art, there's poetry. So this is something that you should definitely get to the most current copy back in the back there. Look to see if you can find yourself adrift in this boat here. Or subscribe online at reformandrevolution.org. So next up, we want people to get on Stack. If you are on Zoom, you can message, is it Brian or is it titled Stack? Or if you're in the room, if you can come around to Brian and put your name forward to get on Stack. We'll have 3-minute contributions. We'll have 10 only, but we hope the discussion happens at an after party as well. So who do we have first up? Sorry? Bill Lemer on Zoom, I assume. And you've got 3 minutes.
Okay, sorry, I had different technical difficulties. But look, I just wanted to suggest that those of the panelists and the organizations that they represent that supported Bernie Sanders might consider doing a balance sheet. And what I'm a political balance sheet, because it seems to me that Bernie Sanders was quoted as defending capitalism, and he supports US imperialism. So I think if the people that supported Sanders in his two campaigns for president would acknowledge that that was a political mistake of enormous proportions, misleading the working class into thinking that a Democratic Party politician, he ran as a Democrat, would gain points for the working class, I think is should be discussed critically. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Do we have Jared here? Yeah, come on up.
Should I take the mic? Okay, thank you. Yeah, I really appreciate the panel and the discussion. Just full disclosure, I'm not a member of DSA. I'm in Freedom Socialist Party. Some of you worked with us on things in the past. I just want to say, well, I agree with a lot of what I heard, and I really appreciate the discussion analysis. I definitely agree with the need for class independence. I definitely agree with the need for breaking with the Democratic Party. But I think that that has to be soon, and that has to be now. And I mean, Philip, you had mentioned about these leaders, you know, these, you know, so-called DSA electeds. You know, I don't ever see AOC or Bernie Sanders, you know, identify themselves as members of DSA. So I guess the question is, why continue to push them? Of course, push them, because they're elected members of Congress, so we should be pushing them anyway. But why keep identifying yourself with them if they're not identifying themselves with you? You know, it seems backwards, and it seems maybe a better approach, or a possible approach, would be a united front. You know, a united front with other leftist groups out who, you know, who
All right, we're still working on technical difficulties. Are we, can people online hear us? Yeah, okay, great. So the next three speakers are Luke Pickrell, Gene Allen, and Ty Moore, I assume. So Luke, for 3 minutes.
Are we unmuted now? Okay.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
So, don't you, I guess this question is more aimed at like the BNR person, really. Essentially, like doing labor work in the labor movement is incredibly important, but don't you think that the sort of like actions of our electeds could undermine whatever work that we do in the labor movement? Like example being like the recent basically breaking of the strike that was voted upon by like three of our members in the House of Representatives. It's like if they vote upon that on the national level, it essentially undermines a great deal of the work that we can do locally through unions. And yeah, I don't really hear much about like electoral discipline except for like the Reform and Revolution guy and like Matthew.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Luke. So the panelists will come in at the end and take up some of these questions and different themes in the discussion. Next up is Gene Allen, Ty, and then Shu Vu. Gene?
Hey, comrades. I basically just have a question about to what degree do you see within DSA part of the problem being, I guess I would say, like a growing, while organizational issues are sometimes over-focused on within DSA, you also spoke to decreasing democracy and decisions being made effectively without member input. And I would like you to do what you can to synthesize those two problems. Like, how are we to resolve increasingly managerial resolutions of our own issues and increasingly top-down resolutions of our own issues without some recourse to organizational reforms? And I'll recede the rest of my time.
Thank you. Ty? Go ahead.
There we go. Thanks so much for all the panelists. I think it's been an excellent, really interesting and necessary discussion. I mean, the main point I wanted to make is I agree with sort of, I think the main thrust of what most panelists were saying, that in order to overcome the crisis in DSA, in order to overcome the wider crisis on the socialist left, that we have to, Marxists have to agitate and organize for things like political independence, for a class struggle fighting labor movement, et cetera. But I wanna make the case that, you know, it's not just that we have to agitate and act, you know, around these politics within DSA. We have to actually, you know, get our shit together as the left. On the ground fights. And I think I'm not, you know, that can take place in lots of spaces, the labor movement, you know, importantly, but I think also within DSA, if the left in DSA does not demonstrate effective leadership in our chapters, doesn't fight for leadership within the chapters, doesn't fight to use leadership positions in the chapters to lead effective fights in the direction of independent politics, why, you know, it's hard to make the case that the rest of the membership should take the Marxist left in the organization seriously and put us into leadership roles and test out the politics that we support. I'm in a relatively small or medium-sized chapter of DSA in Tacoma, Washington, part of the chapter leadership there. And over the last 18 months, you know, I don't have consensus in my chapter, or I'm in a minority on the question of, you know, political independence as a revolutionary Marxist. But I have helped lead a fight to put now a ballot initiative that for a ballot initiative on a tenants' bill of rights, you know, bringing Tacoma, if we win this year, it's going to make Tacoma the, you know, highest standard of tenant rights in the state. We've been able to get the Central Labor Council to back this because of 18 months of organizing, and all the main housing justice organizations to back this. And I think it'll give the possibility of putting DSA in Tacoma, a relatively marginal organization with a couple dozen activists, 400 paper members, on the map as a serious political force. And within that, those of us fighting for political independence say we can leverage this and are openly talking about leveraging this to running independent city council candidates, independent candidates for state legislature, trying to use this fight to develop in practice a model of independent politics, at least at the local level. And I think if we can, if the left in DSA can go into the 2023 convention both agitating and advocating for what's necessary to move DSA past this crisis, while simultaneously pointing to concrete models, concrete examples in our chapters of where we're putting these politics into practice and building, you know, real support both in our chapters and in the wider working class for our politics. That's what's going to be, I think, the critical combination. Philip raised, I agree, I'm part of Reform and Revolution. I agree kind of with the formula that we have a triple crisis. There's a Wrap crisis up. Of leadership, a crisis of organization, a crisis of consciousness. And I think for the Marxist left, we can't just be critics of the existing leadership. We have to also be the most effective, most audacious builders of the organization and of trying to change the mass popular consciousness, or at least the consciousness of the most active layers of the working class that we can mobilize into action behind our campaigns. So let's agitate, but then let's put our politics into practice and demonstrate what's possible on the basis of badass Marxist organizing. I think that's what we need to do. And I hope that all the different caucuses here can unite around what I think is a large degree of agreement to go into the 2023 convention with some concrete proposals and ideas and a leadership slate to move DSA in a better direction.
Thank you, Ty. The next three speakers are Shavu, Honda, and Talon.
Thanks everyone for hosting this talk. Very valuable. So my question is just like about popular fronts versus like a united front. So, you know, I agree we need to break from the Democratic Party, but what happens in every single election cycle is we're facing pressure from union leadership, NGOs, you know, basically like every like left, progressive organization to support the Democrats, right? So for example, if AOC runs, we're gonna be supporting the Democrats. I mean, DSA likely will for the election. So it's, and Popular Front is of course defined as like working people have no say over the strategy. It's the ruling class and it's like big capital. So Popular Fronts always end up, you know, screwing over working people. So what does a united front look like under these conditions where the pressure to ally with the Democrats is so immense? And it would also, and we know that it's a mistake to like, as socialists, to run away from like presidential elections. 2024 is gonna be, you know, like electorally, it's gonna be massive. A lot of people are gonna be politicized during that time. What does a united front look like? That's my question.
Great, thank you. Honda?
There we go, wonderful. Thank you all for hosting such a wonderful event. I think I wanted to pose my question in the context of New York City DSA, right? It is the largest chapter in the organization, and we have Brendan Rosas had a wonderful proposal called the 1-2-3-4 plan that would have put on, you know, steps towards building a workers' party, not necessarily an immediate break, not even a dirty break, but getting us closer to that party surrogate. And as much as we fought very hardly for the proposal and with a united front, I would say, with many of the Marxists and left factions within the organization, it's still lost at about a 2-1 vote in the biggest chapter in the organization. And I think that reflects that there is a level of uncertainty over the political strategy that we ought to take with regard to electoral politics generally. But at the same time, I think it also demonstrates a strong interest, a strong committed minority within the organization to such an approach. With that in mind, how do we, my question to the panelists is, how do we then bring our comrades closer to our positions? How do we politicize them towards our positions? And how do we continue to build out the class character of the organization so it so it will better reflect the composition of the working class in the United States? I think these seem to me to be the most important questions for the organization internally in terms of our strategic direction. And these are very practical questions that must be answered at the level of our chapters, at the level of the organizers, of the cadre who are connecting with our members one-on-one in all of our campaigns and our chapters. And so this also has to be a replicable strategy from the smallest chapter to the biggest chapter. And so I guess my questions once again to the panelists is, how do we politicize our current members to get them closer to our politics and our views? And how do we then also affect the organization in such a way? How do we how do we recruit people? How do we bring people into the organization so it better reflects the composition of the working class?
Great, thank you for that. So we have probably three, four more speakers. We have Talon, Noel, and Stefan. Talon?
Hello. So just a couple of quick things. One, I guess I would have a question for everybody on if there is a strategy or if people are thinking about it enough of how we're gonna build class solidarity with the working class on the right. As everybody knows, last 60 years, they've clawed away at the working class. The right's really pulled a lot of them over. And where I live, that's, all there is. So I guess I want to know what people's opinions are on how we can reach out more and how to try to build a pipeline from the right, further left. And then speaking on the broad coalition, I think, it doesn't get recognized enough. Everybody always talks about needing to build a coalition with the Democrats or to build power, numbers, what have you. And I don't think that's totally necessary. I honestly believe if we were to reach out and collaborate more with other socialist, Marxist, anti-capitalist organizations or had a coalition of those, that would be a lot better serving for us and working class people than working with the Democrats. But I'll cede my time.
Thank you. Noel is next.
Yeah. excuse me. Yeah. And I think with the question of electoral politics and whatnot, I think a lot of that too is, our organization's approach to electoral politics. Also, I think we need to take a step back from just like the, oh, hey, we need our own party and we need to break from the Democrats. We also need to understand how and why socialists should run for office in, bourgeois, quote unquote, democracy. And, those who have heard me speak on this before, yes, broken record perhaps, but yeah. Like, we're not going in there to wheel and deal and make policy. We go into electoral politics as organizers, using the electoral season as a chance to actually go talk to the working class, get our ideas out there. And, if we actually win office, we're not there just to make policy. We're there to point out the sham of bourgeois democracy, call that out and call people to action. And I've posted a couple times linked to the book by August Nymph, The Ballot, the Streets, or Both, how Marx, Engels, and Lenin, viewed electoral politics. I highly recommend reading it. And another thing I saw somebody say in chat, like regarding like how the NPC and, you know, the more like social democratic side of DSA hasn't like been trying to push out, you know, the Marxists. It's like, and somebody saying, well, they haven't needed to. It's like, okay, do we need to be more a thorn in the side of, you know, reformists in power in national, or do we, you know, and not saying that we have to like actively be like, okay, we're splitting, but I think we shouldn't necessarily be like mortally afraid of getting kicked out. You know, then again, also disclosure, I tend to be a little more skeptical of the big tent model than some. But, you know, local DSA is where the actual organizing is going on in town, especially with our labor working group. Shout out to Laura and all the others there. And we've got, what, a dozen and a half Teamsters in our logistics subcommittee. So, yeah, we're actually doing work on the ground there. And, yeah, and also need to figure out how to more connect that with things. Because no matter what we do, we need to be going in as organizers, agitators, and educating the working class, you know, actually building class struggle from below. And I don't know how I am for time, but I will cede the rest or apologize for going over.
Thanks, Noel. Okay, so the final list is the last three speakers will be Stefan, Dan T, and Jesse.
Thanks a lot, everybody, for participating in this debate. My name is Stefan. I'm a member of Reform and Revolution here in Seattle. I think the question is posed, why to engage in DSA, an organization in crisis with an opportunist leadership that is not up to the task of defending working class people and not up to the task of opposing imperialism here in the US? And I think, in an ironic way, that's exactly the reason, because these contradictions are so visible for a whole range of activists and members in DSA. And there's a process happening where I feel like a new generation tried to form a political tool with DSA, and they are experiences right now the limitations of that. I feel this is where Marxists are needed, and I believe that this is a united front. The question is posed about a united front. People spoke about that. I think if you join a united front, let's say we join the front, united front against fascism, we would be free to raise our point of view, make our case how to fight, but we would fight together with everyone in that united front who's in a good, on a good place to actually beat back fascism. I think that DSA offers the opportunity for everyone to join, and I would encourage you, make the case for Marxism, fight with Reform and Revolution to build a Marxist alternative to the current course of the leadership. But I think we are better off if we fight also together to build this tool of a new generation, I mentioned that, of new people coming into the struggle for socialism and in a way to offer also a joint struggle in the streets. I think what Laura did in Portland, or what Philip is doing as a chair here in DSA in Seattle, of giving a lead for the actual work of DSA and making a case for Marxism, that is a successful model of how you can convince people. I think also the impact of the Tempest comrades, of Andy and others at the last convention in 2021 in DSA was based on being an active part of DSA and raising those concerns. That's what I think we all have to do. I don't know whether I've got too few seconds left. I think that's part of the struggles in all these new left formations. People who joined Syriza in Greece and just waited and thought this would be the solution, they got heavily betrayed. Our class, the working class, got betrayed in Syriza. But Syriza was over 3 years the battle point of opposition, of debates, of activists, of new people searching for alternatives. I think it was the job of Marxists to fight this leadership of Syriza and fight for an alternative. And even just in the case then that the crisis comes and it ends like Syriza, to have an alternative and be visible for that. I think what the anti-capitalistas did in Spain was launching together with others Podemos and fighting for Marxist course there. They also, in the end, it didn't work out. I think they had to leave when Podemos entered the government, but they built the voice for a Marxist alternative they built the anti-capitalists themselves. I think, I hope we can keep DSA afloat in this situation of being adrift and win a activist, as many as possible, for a really fundamental different course.
All right, next up is Dan Tricoli and then Jesse here.
Hello?
Hello.
I don't know if you can see me. I'm with a group of people here. My name is Dan Tricoli. He and I'm a teacher in Minneapolis, but I'm with the Seattle member.
Hi. I'm here.
Juliana Dowell, she's a teacher in Renton. And we were just wanting to come in on a little question. Honda was asking, how do we, I'm paraphrasing here, but how do we draw more moderate people in? And I'm assuming to basically a more radical set of politics. And I wanted to connect that a little bit to a question that was raised and discussed a little bit about the rail strike. And to me, it's like, we have to really be stressed that it's very important to stand with people when they're fighting for something they need immediately, which is a lot of labor struggles these days. Union strikes and struggles need to be like really met with not just solidarity, but active support. So there's that. I think our organization could do a much better job of that, probably all over the country. And, but particularly how we relate to it politically. And I think that our members in Congress not standing with them is a problem. It's a big problem. And for socialists, we have to
You're frozen. Okay. We lost you there, Dan, for a moment.
I don't remember where I left off. But anyway, we should stand with the rail strikers, rail workers. I think that it was a problem that our members in Congress didn't do that. We should be calling them out. We don't want to let them. We have to make the ruling class do their agenda to us. We can't just go with it and then accept that as like a pragmatic approach. A socialist job is to stand with the working class no matter what. And again, if we lose, we lose. That's so be it. But we at least have staked our line in the ground that like we stand with working people. We can't ever like allow that to like go on without. We in Minneapolis signed on to Seattle's opposition to that. And I think like we should promote that in the organization.
Great, thank you. It's nice to see people joining together to join the meeting. All right, next up is Jesse to close us out.
Hey everybody, my name is Jesse. I use he and pronouns. I'm a member of R&R and also the co-chair of Portland DSA. And I think that to get to the real crux of this panel, like, you know, is DSA adrift? Is DSA in crisis? I think that each panelist gave a pretty solid indication that the answer to those questions are yes, DSA is adrift. DSA is in crisis. And the main thing I would leave to ask the panelists, and I'm kind of glad I get to be the last person because that means my question is the freshest, is what are the tasks of your formations in the lead up to the 2023 National Convention? Because the reality is, you know, if there is no principled Marxist left that is well prepared for this convention, we may well see a similar result as in 2021, where yes, we may have some market improvements on like a platform, but the organization itself still drifts towards the right in terms of an electoral strategy, in terms of international issues, et cetera. So what are the tasks and plans and necessary actions of your formations in the lead up to the 2023 convention? Thank you.
Great, thank you so much, Jesse. We are actually not running that much over time, so we're actually pretty good. So now we're gonna move into the final discussion from our panelists. So each panelist is going to get 5 minutes to kind of respond to some of the questions and prompts and ideas that comrades have brought up and give their closing thoughts on this panel. And we're going to go in the order of Laura first, then Andy, then Matthew, and then Philip. So Laura, 5 minutes, go ahead.
Thank you. I was going to ask to go first. Oh my God, I have so much I want to say. Amazing comments, very thoughtful. I think a lot of comments sort of touch on or like boil down to, aren't we really mad at AOC and Bowman and Cori Bush? And I would say, yeah, they fucked up. They took an incredibly stupid deal on the railroad bill, and they should have known it wasn't going to work. They should have told union members that strategy of making horse trades is not effective. They should have told them that Nancy Pelosi was fucking them by ordering the sick leave amendment after the main bill. But this singular focus on being mad at AOC and Bowman and Cori Bush is a little bit of a red herring. The horse is out of the barn with a lot of our national electeds. It's really hard to grandfather them into a model of accountability when we didn't get them elected and they don't agree with our electoral strategy. And this is the more important part I really want people to leave considering. DSA members themselves, ourselves, are divided on whether that should be our approach to electoral politics. Look at the 1-2-3-4 resolution that Honda mentioned in New York City that provided a great model of how DSA can approach electoral accountability, but it failed by a margin of 2-1. So any plan for electoral accountability from socialist politicians has to contend with that reality of what DSA members themselves want. You can't say, be accountable to this group of 70,000 people when like the majority of those 70,000 people aren't actually themselves demanding accountability. That doesn't make sense. And I think the reason for that is that we were all taught how the world works under like neoliberal ideology. And it's really hard to relearn that. Analyzing power doesn't come naturally, but a very quick way to learn is by caring deeply about something and then getting betrayed. Suddenly you start thinking, all right, how am I going to win next time? And one of the only places in the world we have to learn and have that experience is in the labor movement. So that's why we in Bread and Roses emphasize that so much. And to the question of so why keep identifying with AOC or other socialist politicians? I think they need to be separated. Not all of the people we're talking about are the same. Like Rashida Tlaib, I would say, is qualitatively different than AOC or Bowman. But you know, they are popular and they do open people's minds to leftist ideas. That's useful, and we do criticize them when they mess up. And what I've learned about a lot of the electeds in Congress is that they have a very small group of staffers who they depend on for a lot of their choices, and that's not what we want. We want them to depend on socialist organization for a lot of their ideas, but we haven't even done our part in reaching out to them, in part with a lot of leaders in national DSA who don't want us to make that relationship. We need a national political committee that is committed to at least extending an opportunity to have that kind of relationship with those people. And a big question that we need to continue to ask in DSA is, what is the purpose of having a socialist in office? Is it to govern, or is it to use their platform to put the socialist banner forward? And not all DSA members agree on the answer to that question. I would say it's both, but mostly the second one. We don't have enough power to leverage something yet, so we're stuck mostly using those candidacies and offices to build the movement. And so if DSA members themselves aren't demanding accountability, that's our fault for not having convinced them that's necessary. In terms of what should we be doing at the national convention, I agree we should have some organizational reforms, especially ones that address the issues of democracy. Something I really hope everyone here listening and in this room can get behind is stipending the National Political Committee and steering committees of national committees like the Labor Commission and the Electoral Committee. That would make democratic decisions actually meaningful, because right now most of our elected leaders don't have time to do the work necessary to put our politics forward. They're stuck, you know, doing their 40-hour week or more jobs and having more sort of staffed, stipended, elected leadership would help a lot with that. And politically, our number one goal for the convention should be to marginalize the insider dirty stay perspective that we have been alluding to here tonight.
Great. Thank you, Laura. All right, next we will go to Andy. Andy, you're up. Go ahead.
So that was interesting. I think at the risk of being rude, I disagreed with literally everything that Laura just said, except that I thought it was very honest that acknowledging that these are not our elected officials, right? I mean, the relationship to these people are, some people ran for office generally. DSA people were like, that person's cool. I want to run. I want to support them. That could be good for us. And then they did that. And then those people got elected completely separate from DSA. And we tried to bank on it opportunistically. I mean, like, that's just the relationship. And it's clear now to everybody that we did that to grow, right? Like, the organization made that decision. And at a certain point, fucking made peace with it and just said, well, like, you know, you can't do anything about it now. We've been doing this for too long. So maybe, I mean, honestly, I have not said this entire evening that anybody should leave DSA. But if there was a reason that I just heard about what the problem with this organization is that is the fundamental understanding in this group now, is that there will not be accountability. We should not expect it. And the baseline of any group that wants to be independent has to be like, you know, some modicum of like independence, like democracy and accountability. So if your baseline here is that we just don't expect that those people are ever going to do what we say, then they are not ours. And we should stop pretending that they are. So like, I'm sorry, like I understand, like this is, it's just a disagreement at a certain point. But I also think most working class people are really fucking good at power analysis, which is why they understand how to take risks and when not to take risks. And if we haven't fucking convinced them that what our alternative is useful and like something that's not going to just be completely a waste of their time, then that's on us, right? So, you know, a lot of this is just crazy to me. You know, I think like this question about like, how do we, you know, like for one, like, I completely disagree with the idea that DSA is a very democratic organization. It is not a very democratic organization. And part of my response to how DSA is working is that at this last convention, people, like, there were some basic democratic, like, ideas about how to have this organization come together, right? Like, hey, it would be nice, like, if we had some membership control over the National Political Committee. And people voted it down, including Brendan Rose's people who campaigned actively against it. So I just call bullshit on this idea that that there's something like, you know, like some interest in like democratizing the organization. I just don't see that anymore. And then later when the Bowman affair happened and that question became a live active question, people sided on the wrong fucking side of that again. And then the national leadership went and disciplined not Bowman, but the working group. So yes, people have been disciplined in this organization politically. So I completely respect people's desire to go to the 2023 convention and go and fight the good fight. I feel like I've been there and I've tried a lot of that also. Like we, like to Ty's point, like you got two people from Mighty Madison here because our chapter has really tried to build that. And we've led the way on a lot of shit in this organization, but you know, we're not an island, right? And people get demoralized in our chapter also because of the decisions of the national organization. So, I mean, like, is this organization in a drift? Yes. I think a lot of people have never been in any other type of organization. And I kind of question whether there's a fear of leaving, right? Because you just don't know what to do, as opposed to a solid political argument about the basis to stay. Now, again, I'm still a member, right? But like, if you're saying that these things are important, we have to make a political calculation at a certain point about what is really there.
And I've heard even from people like Honda, who I hate, that, you know, that plan won't even work on its most watered down version in New York. So there are some questions to be asked. All right. Well, thank you very much. Spicy takes, but, you know, here we are.
All right. Thank you, Andy. Okay, so next we have Matthew. Go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, so, you know, I think my position will be somewhere in between Laura and Andy's. I think it actually does really matter to pose politics concretely and ambitiously in relation to the elected officials who are members of DSA and endorsed by the organization. You know, we endorse someone, we have pretty high standards compared to most other, you know, NGOs, lobbying groups, et cetera. And we expect people to adhere to certain standards. And, you know, even in not endorsing Jamal Bowman in 2022, we said something about, you know, where a DSA endorsed politician lies. I think that there was a lot of opportunism on the NPC thinking, oh, even after this guy votes to fund an, you know, US imperialism and an apartheid state in the Middle East, we can have some sort of relationship with him. But right now, you know, they basically don't believe we can have any sort of relationship with him, which is why they don't even include him for criticism when they're criticizing the other DSA members in Congress for, you know, voting to crush the rail strike. So I think it matters a lot to point out that there is this contradiction in DSA's politics where we think we have high standards, we think we have principles, but we actually have no working active relationship, as Laura said, with these people who are supposed to be our representatives. And I don't think it's as cynical and detached a decision on our part to have that sort of relationship. Like, I don't think we just do it because they're popular. I think that a lot of people in this organization want to have that sort of relationship where we actually control these people. And it's true that the leadership just hasn't pursued that or made that a priority of the organization. I think it was revealed from some members of the National Political Committee that AOC's office was open to having regular meetings with the National Political Committee of DSA. And the NPC was just too incompetent to schedule meetings that enough that a few of them could attend to meet with her regularly. So we haven't even tried to make them our instruments in Congress. And so I think that putting forward, you know, hey, we have this theory of what a member of a socialist organization in a legislative body should be doing. They should be acting as a radical opposition party, voting down military spending, voting down support for apartheid states, voting against any attempt to, you know, illegal, you know, to force a tentative agreement on workers who had rejected it. You know, they should be an intransigent opposition against, you know, both the liberal and the right, you know, the reactionary factions of the capitalist class. We haven't even said that that's a thing that they could be doing and asked them to do it. So I think we, you know, should be saying that's what we want and projecting it to these people before we just write them off. Because that's not even something that we've tried to create in our electoral work. And I think that does have, you know, link back to this problem of the dirty stay or you know, the sort of opportunist inside trader, you know, direction in DSA's electoral strategy that Honda mentioned and that Laura mentioned, that I do think our task is to marginalize. But, you know, it is the case that that is about, you know, 60% to two-thirds of the organization, as the national convention in 2021 showed with the failure of Amendment 5 to Resolution 8 that posed much better, you know, organizational discipline for and a much more ambitious electoral strategy. And with the failure of 1-2-3-4 in New York, it's true that, you know, we have a partyist minority and a liquidationist majority. And so how do we win? I don't know that we can You know, we should absolutely organize as hard as we can for the 2023 convention, and we should pose these sort of proposals very starkly and make strong arguments for them. Something like, you know, in the strongest form, I think something like the Tribunes of the People resolution proposed by Marxist Unity Group in 2021, or, you know, I would be in favor of uniting a, you know, advocating for part of a coalition for something like 1-2-3-4 at a national level. I think that that is incredibly important to advocate for that strongly. And then on the local level, as Ty was saying, you know, forging the path by doing it, you know, having people who are doing politics differently is important as well, because that shows the other thing that they could, that these members in Congress could be doing rather than what they are doing. And so, you know, I think that actually means that taking electoral politics and taking high politics, not just movement work, you know, movement on the ground work, that means that it's incredibly important, because I think the socialist movement taking on the lead on, you know, high level class struggle questions is historically incredibly important. When the Socialist Party of America was formed in 1901, it had about 4,000 members and union density was like 7%. But the creation of a socialist organization and political culture was incredibly important for building, you know, a militant layer in the trade unions. So I think the socialist movement is incredibly important. I think getting there in DSA toward a partyist conception of what DSA should be means having stronger political debate, making these arguments to people about what DSA should be doing. And that's why, you know, we need a real party press. You know, we need resolutions around red lines for the organization, like anti-imperialism for people we support. And so these are some of the main tasks in the 2023 convention and going forward in DSA.
Great. Thank you, Matthew. All right. Now we will have our final response from Philip. Go ahead, Philip.
Okay. Definitely the meeting got a little more lively towards the end. were the votes of AOC, Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman, Rashida Tlaib on the railway strike, obviously all, not all, some, there was exceptions here and there, but on the railway strike, on funding for the IDF, for going along with US imperialism on the war in Ukraine, was that a surprise from a Marxist perspective? No. The DSA electeds are not up to the task politically, and it's inherent in their politics. And there will be more votes like that. And I think a Marxist assessment has to start with, if Marxists aren't clear about that, that's a problem. Speaking on behalf of my caucus, Reform Revolution, we are clear about that. And we do, and that's not too surprising that they've done that. What's the conclusion you draw from that? You know, what is going to be, what's necessary to have socialist elected officials in US Congress that can actually stand to the up against the pressures of capitalism, against the mass media, against the machine of co-optation and incorporation that exists once you're in that space? You do need a much broader advanced layer of the working class that has a socialist vision, that's engaged and active in democratic membership, member-run organizations. And you need an organization like that that can hold them accountable. Now, you can use that analysis as an excuse and apologize for the socialist electeds for not representing DSA and not representing to the working class. And obviously we don't have a representative of the socialist majority caucus here. And we should obviously give them the chance to explain the view, but to explain honestly, that's how I perceive the SM, the socialist majority caucus position. The majority of the NPC is to apologize for these electeds when they do that, pointing, I think, to some accurate analysis that reflects the weakness of our own organizations and our own class. There's truth in that, but the conclusion is not to apologize for them. The conclusion is to educate an activist layer that's capable of holding them to account. You don't educate them by saying, oh, that's fine, they did that. That doesn't educate and begin to change the situation. You need to speak openly, you need to point to what's needed, and you need to build towards that, even if it's not immediately realizable. And I think we build our own strength by doing that. We send a message. If you want to fight this, you need to get active. You need to get involved. If you want to fight it, I'd also say to left critics, and you need to help fight to build a majority in DSA. And I want to, in that sense, address also two sides of what Andy was saying and Laura was saying about the electeds. I mean, just first, I do an appeal. I think it's fine. It's good that we have open, frank debate and disagreement. But I think it's important that we do that in a comradely, respectful way. There's a huge problem in DSA. There's two things. There's not enough open discussion debate. And R&R believes that's critical. And that's why we're organizing these things. But also in the few moments when it does burst out, it bursts out in really brutal, uncomradely, personalized ways. And we need to really fight that culture and fight for a politicized democratic culture in DSA. But on the substance of the issue, I think, you know, there's what Laura said about the horses out of the barn. I thought that was really, you know, put her finger on the issue there, that the electeds have their own approach. It's not so easy to walk them back. I agree, but I think the task, and I think it's also true what the point that I think Matthew made this point, there's not currently a majority that we've won yet in DSA to say that we expect our electeds, and our position is electeds need to represent DSA, and that DSA sets a position and that's their job to fight for it. And it's not the job of DSA to protect electeds, and to defend electeds. It's the job, obviously, in a certain sense, we want to do that. Number one task is for the electeds to defend and fight for the DSA and the socialist movement. We haven't won that majority yet in DSA. So I think that is, yes, we need to fight. And I think this year's national convention is an opportunity, even if we win it, to prove that. I think also if we do win that majority at a certain stage, we need to have a dialogue and debate with those electeds and seek to convince them. And that's part of also winning a majority in DS for necessary. If we just, I think it's a big mistake, this idea we just need immediate expulsions in an unprepared fashion. If electeds are not representing our needs and our organization, it has to be prepared, and you have to win a majority to understand that is necessary. And you can't just proclaim that. And so I think we need to win a majority in DSA for a party type position. We need to convince the elected, convince them, remove them. But I would say if out of that process, they are not moved and they continue not representing DSA, it's untenable. There has to be a process, a politically prepared process, where you carry as much of the membership as possible, but it has to be a process of separation where people who do not represent DSA cannot represent DSA. At the end of the day, that can only last for so long, that we have people representing our organization who are not representing our organization. And we need a struggle to transform that. Either they have to get in line, or we need a process of overcoming that. So I think this year's national convention is a big opportunity for Marxist forces in DSA to come together, to collaborate and fight together on this question of the Democratic Party, socialist electoral strategy. But also, I really agree about fighting for democratic reforms within our organization, for the MPC to be the supreme force, not the staff, and to build also a broader leadership structure in DSA that can help the MPC, but also hold the MPC accountable.
Great. Thank you, Philip. All right. So with that, we are at the end of our discussion for tonight. But before people leave, just have a few things that we'd like to say. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here, both in person and on Zoom. Particularly, thank you to all of our panelists who made this dynamic and engaged discussion possible, as well as thank you to all of the folks in the audience who have contributed to the discussion. So we'll post the video and audio from this discussion on our website. You can check it out at reformandrevolution.org. Thank you to Amy and all the others who organized the tech infrastructure tonight to make the recording and the operation of this hybrid meeting possible. Thank you. You can also visit our website to find out more about Reform and Revolution Caucus. As we've heard tonight, as DSA and the socialist left navigates this period of crisis and turmoil, it is essential that Marxist caucuses and DSA collaborate with each other and win the masses to our perspectives. R&R is building a Marxist force in DSA to do just that. We encourage all of our comrades here in person and on Zoom to consider subscribing to our magazine at reformandrevolution.org/subscribe, to donate to R&R at reformandrevolution.org/donate, and to consider applying to join our caucus if you've agreed with the perspectives that we've outlined here at reformandrevolution.org
ecosystem.org/join.